There we go. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I'm your host, Ken Molman, and this is the My Matters Radio Network. Oh, boy, what a week. What a week. I've been absolutely slammed with work, and it's been kind of interesting. The busy, and I don't know if everybody else is getting crushed at work lately, but I certainly am, and I guess it's better than not having a job, but boy, it's getting pretty rough out there, and I hear other people say the same thing, that that they're also getting crushed with work, and I don't know, maybe it's just me, maybe it's everybody, maybe it's just some of us, but you know, I've said this before, and I guess I jinxed it. The last time we had the situation where we're getting crushed, I was really, really busy for, I don't know, 3 or 4 months like this, and the economy finally turned around. I don't know if that's going to happen this time or not, you know, but we'll get to that now, get to that soon. We'll know in the near future. We'll touch on why I say that here in just a little bit. Anyway, to start out on a silly note, as usual, we have the random political rhetoric generator, and we always like to start with this every week. The randomly generated political rhetoric this week is, when I'm elected, I'll make sure pharmaceutical companies and corrupt labor unions can't destroy our reality TV shows. I love the random generator. Sometimes it's a little more insightful than others, and sometimes it's just downright silly. And, well, tonight was just downright silly, but that's all right. Anyhow, so I guess we should dive into business here. And I should mention, if you'd like to call in tonight, you can do so by calling area code 858-683-1326. That's 858-683-1326. All right, getting to it here. There was a interesting article just kind of floating around, people that Google their state and, you know, why is whatever the name of their state is so whatever. And the Google autocomplete comes up and explains to you or tries to say what most people search for. You say that. So when you type in why is Kentucky so, and then Google autocomplete, the top thing that comes up is poor. So why is Kentucky so poor? Well, that's a long question, or a short question with a long answer, I should say. And, you know, quite frankly, it's kind of complex, but, you know, the short version, and I've been thinking about this issue a lot, a whole lot. You know, we just recently had the anniversary of the declaration of the war on poverty, and like its associated war on projects, has been pretty much a failure in general. The war on poverty has not cured poverty. It has spent a lot of money, and it spent a lot of money on things that have kept people level. I mean, it keeps them alive. We have food stamps and we have housing assistance, and that keeps people alive. But we're now 2.5 or so generations into this thing. And are people really better? That's my question. Are people really better off? And it got me thinking about this beyond all the other issues that are out there. And there are some issues that are really driving some of this, you know, the corruption in counties and our education system. And I mean, there's lots of problems in Kentucky. But from a federal perspective, why is Kentucky so poor when the war on poverty was declared right here in Kentucky? And I've been thinking about this quite a bit. We've spent a lot of money. Again, you know, food stamps, housing assistance, but nobody's really getting ahead. Eastern Kentucky has been in perpetual 25%-ish unemployment for as long as I've been paying attention to their unemployment rate. I don't know how long it's really been, but it's been a while. And it really gets me thinking that, you know, poor economy aside, there are certain areas of the state where there are more people than there are jobs. And there's really nothing that can be done about that. Not to pick on Eastern Kentucky, but, you know, Eastern Kentucky has an interesting geography. You've got the mountains. You've got issues of accessibility. You know, the problem is that there is no good way to industry there. And certainly I think that there was opportunities very much squandered. Given the line of work that I'm in IT, one of the things that we see a lot are data centers. And data centers consume a lot of power. You've got a lot of heating and cooling issues. And then, of course, all the computers that are running consume a lot of power. And I have to wonder if we didn't miss an opportunity to put a bunch of data centers into Eastern Kentucky. With all that Eastern Kentucky coal, the power would have been relatively cheap. But now, of course, with the whole war on coal, or whatever you want to call it, energy prices are going up if you're powered by coal because they're shutting down some of the coal plants and making it very difficult to open new ones. And when I say very difficult, I think I really mean impossible, but I don't know. There might be an exception or two out there. The problem, I guess, is I don't know. We've got 25% unemployment in Eastern Kentucky. And all of this war on poverty stuff got me really thinking about what are we doing? We've, you know, spent the better part of five or six decades trying to get people, actually really it goes back even further than that if you want to go back to FDR. But we've spent a lot of time and a lot of money making it so people don't starve. Great. But that's really a short-term fix. That's a Band-Aid. That's not addressing the core problems that are causing people to be in these situations to begin with. Now, I'm not a big government guy. Anybody who regularly listens to the show knows that. But I also am very pragmatic. I know that you can't end welfare, food stamps, housing assistance overnight. We now have multiple generations that have grown up in a system that has provided for them and has had no incentive for people to have to go better themselves. And that's just the reality. We have multiple generations that literally do not have a work ethic because they weren't taught it. There was no incentive for it. The other issue you have are people that are basically trapped in those situations. There is no opportunity for them to get ahead, which then creates a disincentive to try. Because your likely outcome, it's like playing the lottery almost, I guess, where the likelihood of success is slim. And unlike the lottery, where it only costs a dollar or two to play, you know, even though it's insurmountable odds, you know, getting a job and working, there's a lot more at stake. The problem is that our system specifically disincentivizes people at the bottom to try to work to get themselves out. There are benefit cliffs where once you make a certain amount of money, all of a sudden you lose significant benefits that basically trap people at that lower bracket because it's not possible. And I'm trying to remember, I believe the graph that I saw showed that at $29,000 or so, it was either $29,000 or $29,001, you lose about $40,000 worth of economic benefits, programs, housing assistance, child assistance, all that kind of stuff. And you don't ever really catch up until you're making $66,000 a year. Well, that's a pretty significant jump. You're talking about having to more than double your income in order to make it worth trying to make more money. And, of course, the reality is nobody's going to jump from $29,000 to $66,000 overnight. That's just not going to happen. you know, economy aside, even in a good economy, the chances of that happening are slim to none. You know, I personally, I was in a booming deal in the middle of the tech boom, and I, you know, moved jobs and whatnot to move up the pay scale, but even I didn't jump up quick. And I'm a rare situation in my scenario where moving up the ranks happened really fast because of the circumstances at the time. But I didn't go from $29,000 to $66,000 overnight. I did it pretty quick, but not overnight. And I'd say pretty quick, relatively speaking, over the course of a handful of years. But that's really fast. I mean, most people, you switch jobs, you might get a 10% bump. Usually it's more like 5. Your cost of living increase is, what, 2, 3% per year if you get it? Yeah. What this all comes back to, I guess, and where I'm going with this, I have to wonder if it wouldn't have been smarter to invest a little bit more 50 years ago or whatever, to take those people who are in eastern Kentucky or in other perpetually economically depressed parts of the state and move them, offer them the opportunity to move to where the jobs are. Now, I know some of my friends will scream, what are you talking about? That's more money. You're spending more money. Yeah, we are, initially. But the idea behind it is twofold. Number one, we saw after Hurricane Katrina that a bunch of people that were in Louisiana living off the government were evacuated by FEMA to other places. And that was done because there were no shelters that could handle that number of people within the state. They had to push people to other states. And so when everything was cleaned up, there was a big controversy because a lot of people weren't coming back and were very public about, I'm not going back to Louisiana. The reasons they gave were that they had moved to a place where there were jobs and they had got a job. And they had made themselves better, and they were living a better lifestyle. And I have to wonder if, offered the opportunity, if people wouldn't do the same thing. Because in the end, there are people in economically depressed areas that want to get out. They have the desire to get out. They're, you know, it's not the stereotypical, I'm here just collecting a check. I'm happy just collecting a check. There's people that want to get out. And somewhere along the way, if you're ever to break the cycle of dependence, you have to provide, or there has to be, I don't need to know that it has to be provided, but there has to be a mechanism by which someone can get ahead. If you're in eastern Kentucky and your unemployment rate sits at 25% for a decade or two decades, I don't know how long it's been. What that tells me is that there are just not enough jobs in that area to support the number of people who could be working, period. There's just not. And given that, generally speaking, about 5% of the population is unemployed at any time, if you subtract the 5% off of the 25% unemployment rate, you're now down to 20%. And that tells me that there's about 20% too many people in eastern Kentucky for the number of jobs that are available. And so I have to wonder if 40, 50 years ago, the government had, instead of just saying, hey, we're going to pay for welfare and your food stamps and housing assistance for the next 5 decades, if they had instead said, hey, we'd like to offer you the opportunity to move where there are jobs. I have to wonder if perhaps, obviously not everyone would succeed, but would we have more successes, fewer people actually on those government assistance programs? Would people actually have been made better? Because that's always what the goal supposedly was anyway. of these programs. They were supposed to be making people better. They weren't, but they were supposed to. And so I have to wonder, again, if it were possible, and some of this is hindsight speaking, of course, but would it have been better to just put people where the jobs were? Would that have solved the problem? I don't know. Maybe. Certainly what we're doing now doesn't get anyone ahead. If anything, it makes them subservient. And that's not good. And given the reality of the situation, we're not going to be able to change overnight. As I said, you've got generations that there were no jobs. There have not been any jobs since they've been alive. They don't even know what it's like to be in a place with jobs. And so I have to wonder if that wouldn't have been a better way to go about it. That's just something that's been bugging me a lot this past week. And then, you know, and I've been talking about this to a handful of different folks for the past, I don't know, week or two. And let's see, what, today, yesterday, I guess it was, the Herald Leader had a story about a poll that came out that showed that the majority, by a huge margin in Kentucky, want to raise minimum wage. That's a 2-to-1 margin, want the minimum wage to be increased. The proposal is for the increase to be from $7.25 an hour, our current minimum wage, to $10.10 per hour, which is a fairly significant jump. That's not quite 50%. It's about a little over 40%. That's a pretty significant jump in the minimum wage. And I don't know, I look at this and I think, boy, is that something that's going to make the state wealthier? You know, in economic terms, just basic economic terms, when your local area is bringing in more money than it's putting out, then you're basically winning, right? You're bringing new dollars into the community, which means new wealth into the community. Is raising the minimum wage really going to increase wealth in Kentucky? And I would venture to say the answer is no, because the same amount of wealth is out there, at least immediately. And the downside of it is that your low-skill labor is going to be further incentivized to move somewhere else, whether that's another state that doesn't increase minimum wage or to a country. And does that really help? I don't think that it does. It may feel good to raise minimum wage, but and I don't know if the state proposal has this, but apparently the federal proposal is looking at exempting mom-and-pop shops, which I think is pretty interesting, kind of like Obamacare, you know, exempts companies with under 50 workers. I think it's very interesting. It would be interesting to see what it would do to the economy, but I have a very strong suspicion that in the end, especially if it's not a national minimum wage, but even if it is a national minimum wage, that in the long run, Kentucky will become a poorer state. Now, how do I say that? Well, I say that because, first of all, we have had inflation already. Minimum wage is only one factor in what causes inflation. So there's lots of things that cause inflation, and quite honestly, the amount of money that the Federal Reserve has printed over the past decade or so is probably more effective. It's probably going to affect inflation more than raising minimum wage. But there's not new dollars coming in that scenario. It's not that all of a sudden the minimum wage going up in Kentucky is bringing new dollars to the state. It's not. It's just not. And it's not going to make the state richer. What it will do is certain companies will scale back their workforces, although they've already been scaled back, so maybe the minimum wage hedge here is that companies can't scale back any further. But that doesn't stop them from moving out of state. And I don't know what other states are considering the minimum wage. I haven't looked at that. I honestly didn't think that this had a shot in Kentucky, and I'm obviously out of touch on this issue, because if two-thirds of the state are in favor of raising the minimum wage, which is basically what this story is saying, it's probably going to happen. I don't see how you stop that train. I think maybe there's a push to lower the amount. Maybe you don't get the full $10.10 per hour. Maybe it'll be 8-something or 9-something. But obviously, the issue has popular support. And, it's popular with 73% of Democrats, 59% of independents, 45% of Republicans. I mean, almost half of Republicans support it. It's going to be very, very difficult to stop any sort of minimum wage increase. The ones who win, and in case you're unaware, the ones who actually win in minimum wage increases are labor unions and people who get paid the prevailing wage stuff. Because what that does, they automatically have built into their contracts that whatever percentage minimum wage goes up is the percentage that their salaries go up. So if somebody's making $40 an hour and minimum wage goes up, they're all of a sudden going to be making $56 an hour based on the numbers that they're proposing here, right? A 40% increase of $40 is $16. So $40 an hour plus $16 an hour is $56 an hour. That's a pretty significant jump. You're talking about just over $80,000 to, what is that, about $114,000 a year? That's a fairly significant jump for where someone who's got such a contract. The average person won't see that. Most of us won't see that big jump. Those on minimum wage will see the jump temporarily. But as with all things, labor will adjust, the cost of goods will adjust, things will adjust. And in the end, the only ones who are really winning in a minimum wage fight are the people who are in the unions. They're the only ones who come out on top. Everybody else does not. It does provide the ability for the state to not raise income tax, but collect more taxes because those people are now making more money, right? The ones at the bottom, so they're paying a higher percentage of tax, so they don't have to pass something that raises taxes, but just does so de facto. But I don't think that's going to solve the problem. What I do think is going to solve the problem, and there was a story here, this is about a week old now, about the story about Wildcat Moving. And I don't know if you all are involved or have followed this story, but Wildcat Moving sued the state of Kentucky because the state of Kentucky has a certificate of need program when it comes to moving companies. Certificate of need programs basically establish that there is an artificial cap, the number of businesses that are allowed to operate in a certain area. In many ways, that's a big problem with our medical costs. The certificate of need programs limit the number of hospital beds per X thousand of people. I forget how exactly it works, but there's a mathematical formula that says based on this number of people in the area, you can have this many hospital beds in the area. And what does that lead to? A lack of competition. What does a lack of competition lead to? Well, for one, it leads to, when I went to the ER for something that turned out to be nothing, a charge of $3,000 for an ER room for 3 hours. Nowhere else could you ever, ever get away with charging $1,000 an hour for pretty much anything. I mean, that's a ridiculous amount of money. But in the case of Wildcat Moving, the certificate of need was based on whether or not other movers, a.k.a. the competition, decided that there needed to be someone else in the field. So basically, they're creating a de facto good old boys network that has incentive to prevent other competition from coming in and busting up that good old boys network or charging less for their services. And on February 3rd, U.S. District Judge Danny Reeves issued a decision that basically strikes down the certificate of need law in Kentucky when it comes to movers. Now, that says that's not everything, right? That's not all certificates of need, but it does knock it down for moving companies, which is a step in the right direction. It allows new people, unemployed people, who just decide, you know what, I've got a back, I've got two legs, I've got arms, I can carry stuff. Hey, I've got access to a truck to go out and start being a moving company. And so what this means, it's an economic victory. It means that one more barrier has been knocked down that prevents people from being able to go out and start a company. It prevents people from going out and trying to make themselves better. All these licenses and regulations and all this stuff, a lot of this stuff is very very petty stuff that specifically is built in by the people already in the industry. They lobby regulators to make it so that the competition can't exist. It's protectionism. Get rid of the protectionism. Let local, normal people start businesses. Start, if you're going to do big government programs, at least do them smart. Actually let people get ahead. Of course, there's incentive to not let people get ahead on the politicians' part, but we'll save that for another day. Let people get ahead. Let people create their own jobs. And that's just part of a recipe for success. And of course, there's a whole lot more, but I don't want to get into all that tonight. We've got a lot to cover, and somehow I've managed to take up a half an hour talking about this. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to take a break here. And when we come back, we've got, as I mentioned, a lot to cover. But stay tuned. We'll be back here in just a few minutes. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network.
We'll be right back. First impressions aren't the most important thing. They're the only thing. At Ernie's Print Shop, we'll produce what you need to represent your company professionally. Right now, you can get 1,000 full-color business cards, 1,000 4x6 postcards, or a 3x5 banner for just $60. You choose. Check us out at erniesprintshop.com. Ernie's Print Shop. Over 50 years, one source, one solution. erniesprintshop.com. 502-969-8585.
Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springsteen of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email MyViewMatters at AOL.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
All right, folks, and we're back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. And as mentioned in the past, there are other shows on the network. We're here, actually, the network's here Sunday through Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And Monday through Wednesday is the Ed Springsteen Show, and Thursday is Thursday Night Truth with Dale the Truth. So turn into those shows as well. They're different than mine, but we're all out here on the network and provide, I believe, quality entertainment and quality material for you. So anyway, getting back to it here. All right. Let's see here. Miscellaneous things. New Direction Kentucky was launched about a week and a half ago or so. New Direction Kentucky is, in theory, a group that is going to work to, well, it's not in theory, they say they're going to work to change the state House of Representatives to Republican. And that's what they're planning on doing. And some of the names out here that I recognize are Hilda Legg, Todd Peeple, and Alicia Webb Eddington. Those are folks involved in this, as well as Hal Heiner. Now, Hal Heiner is rumored to be looking at a gubernatorial run in 2015, and Hal Heiner seems to be kind of the head of this beast thing created here. And I can't help but maybe be a little jaded or a little pessimistic, or I don't know what the right word is. But I suspect that, in part, this is really to raise Hal Heiner's profile before the 2015 election season, and hopefully, and I guess maybe hopefully get some people that are behind him so that when he runs, in theory, when he runs in 2015, he will be not running with no support and no name. He'll have some folks that are helping him. Let's see. Of other interest, the New York SAFE Act, the gun control law they passed that was kind of silly, there's now a new AR-15 that's been released that complies with all the measures in the law. And, of course, that's got the pro-gun people all up in a tizzy, but basically they've modified the AR-15, which is a very highly modifiable weapon, to comply with the New York SAFE Act. And there it is, you know, free market strikes again. If there's a market for something, people will find a way to spend. Oh, boy. And Obamacare. Boy, you know, we haven't talked a lot about Obamacare in the last month or so, but Obamacare is taking a monstrous beating. And, you know, of course, we've talked about this here on the show lots and lots of times and how things aren't right. And it's not going to be what they're not going to turn out well. And basically, the big to-do now is that the Congressional Budget Office has come out and said that in the long run, Obamacare will ensure fewer people and it will cost jobs. So, in other words, Obamacare disincentive will make it so that employers don't want to hire people. And it's pretty funny, the spin that was put on this. I forget which Democratic legislator said, well, that's great because that means people can spend more time at home with their kids instead of working. What? That's a hell of a spin on, hey, I can't get a job. Well, hey, you get to spend more time at home. Really? That's the spin you've got or the answer you've got? That's insane. And basically, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that Obamacare, solely Obamacare, will reduce the net number of hours worked by 1.5 to 2% between 2017 and 2025. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but think about that. What that really means is that 1.5 to 2% of our workforce will no longer be needed. Now, we already have fewer people working now than we have since the 70s, as far as the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Of course, I'm not going to be able to find that chart at the very moment, but the Bureau of Labor Statistics is sitting down around 63% of the labor participation rate produced by the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that the labor participation rate is about 63%. And that's down from a high when Bush was in office of 66%, which basically means that there are 3% fewer people. That's not the right way to say that. Of the people eligible and able to work, it was 66% of those people at the time that Bush was in office were working. And now 63% of those who are eligible are working, which means that overall there is 3% fewer people in the workforce, period. Now, understand that's workforce, period. That doesn't speak to hours or anything like that. And we've heard, of course, of people being scaled back to part-time. I know a good number of people, friends of mine, who have been scaled back to part-time because of, well, they blamed it on Obamacare, but I really think it was more about the general economy in general. Things just aren't real great out there, and everyone knows that. And so basically, they're saying, according to this other article here, originally the 2011 estimate for Obamacare was that 800,000 people would leave the workforce as a result of Obamacare. The new number is that 2.3 million will be forced out of the workforce due to Obamacare. Oh, excuse me. It's not forced out. It does say that the reduction will largely be due to people opting out of work. I guess primarily because now they don't have to work because they get health insurance anyway. I don't really quite understand where that number comes from, but it does say it will largely be due to people opting out of work. Boy, I can't imagine opting out of work and just saying, you know what, I don't feel like going to work anymore. I could imagine and dream that, but I don't see how that's really reasonable. Wow. And let's see here. Boy. So, yeah, originally they said that 7 million people were going to have to sign up for the exchange. Now they're down to just 6 million people will need to sign up for the exchange. I don't know. It's very interesting. The Obamacare stuff, the news is not good. Oh, here's the thing about escaping jobs. Wow, it was Pelosi. Obamacare allows workers to escape their jobs. That's kind of a funny way to put that. I have to wonder if she really meant it that way or not. Yeah, so job lock. They're talking about job lock, where you can't switch jobs because you'll have a pre-existing condition. But that's not what the Congressional Budget Office was talking about. And that's what this article points out, is that Pelosi and them are trying to spin this as job lock is going to be eliminated by this. And in some ways it will. I mean, make no mistake, if you have insurance outside of your employer, that, and now the pre-existing condition thing is gone, yeah, you don't have to stay just because you have insurance through them and you would have a pre-existing condition otherwise. But that's not where these job losses are coming from. These are overall net losses to the economy. And so that's, yeah, not good. And meanwhile, voters still remain pretty steadfastly against the health care law. Real Clear Politics' current average is that the over-under for against versus for support versus oppose, those against or opposing Obamacare is now up by 13.3. So basically, those against are pulling at 51.6. Those in favor are pulling at 38.3. So overall, more people are still against Obamacare. And actually, it's been that way from the start. Obamacare has never had over 50% support. So, in fact, it's never had above 43%. So, it's bad. And in fact, as a result, Gallup ran a poll, and the plurality of Americans say that Obamacare is Obama's biggest failure. And it's pretty interesting. The biggest failures, the greatest achievements. And it's funny because 22% of Americans say that Obamacare is his greatest achievement, but 36% of Americans say it was his biggest failure. So obviously, and you can look down the rest, these are all single-digit numbers for everything else. Obamacare is definitely going to be Obama's legacy. And I think for those that whine about it being the Affordable Care Act versus Obamacare, I think that it's pretty appropriate to call it Obamacare. I mean, this is going to be his legacy. It is definitely the only thing of real controversy to get crammed through. And it is the reason why the Republicans took the House back over in 2010. And they seem pretty confident they're going to be able to take it over the Senate in 2014. We'll see. And speaking of we'll see, sorry, I can't help but laugh. This story is in the National Journal, and it says, the title is Mitt Romney is the 2016 Republican frontrunner, with the subtitle of This is Not an Onion, in quote, story. And if those of you not familiar with The Onion, it's probably the oldest parody spoof news site where they just make up crazy things and, you know, unreasonable things, headlines and stories. This is legit. Mitt Romney is the 2016 Republican frontrunner. Now, I have seen another story more. Mike Huckabee is the frontrunner instead. And, oh, dear Lord. I mean, if it's either of those two, you know, Hillary's got a real shot at winning, no matter how bad Obama's doing. And I've seen the graphs and the charts, and he's trending bad. I mean, it's not going to end well by the end. And Hillary's going to have a really hard time climbing over that hurdle if indeed she is the nominee, which is likely on the Democratic side at this point. She's going to have a hell of a hurdle if that's the case. But, hey, you can always overcome the hurdle by the Republicans throwing the worst candidate in the world out there, or the second worst, which they have Romney and Huckabee are their worst two, probably. I would say Santorum's probably number three. And, you know, that's a good way to go ahead and lose, I guess, if your goal is to lose. Well, mission accomplished, as they say. But I can't believe that that's really the case. I would really hope Republicans were smart enough to choose somebody besides Romney or Huckabee or Santorum. Those guys can't win. Straight up, they cannot win. And, you know, it's really unfortunate. I mean, the reality is that there will be other candidates in the race besides the Democratic and Republican candidates. But I don't know that people are mad enough yet to go another way. I just don't think they're angry enough yet. I'm hoping they'll get angry enough. I'm hoping that, for instance, on my side of things, the Libertarian Party side, we can continue to put forth the case that we need to go a completely different direction. But, you know, it's really hard. The media likes to ignore, and when they're not ignoring us, they marginalize us. So it's very difficult. I mean, just right now, these polls for the Kentucky Senate race, it's very interesting watching these polls. The latest poll that came out contradicts a poll that came out, I don't know, about 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, actually about a week and a half ago. Actually, that's just been a week ago when it came out, but it was conducted about a week and a half ago. They surveyed 500 likely voters in Kentucky and found that McConnell and Grimes were tied at 42% each, with 10% undecided and 6% saying someone else. Matt Bevin, by contrast, was ahead by a few points over Grimes in a head-to-head competition. And Bevin was creeping up on McConnell, but still pretty far behind. I think he was 20 or maybe 25 points behind. He's still creeping up, though, and he was making some headway. Well, since that time, the McConnell camp has stepped up the radio ads to the point where I'm actually hearing them now. They're running them even in northern Kentucky, which I think is interesting because typically speaking, well, the rest of you guys in the state ignore us up here. I always joke that northern Kentucky was the area of the state forgotten about second most often, just behind western Kentucky. But McConnell's ads are out there, and they're, you know, saying Mitch is great and Bevin's bad. And they fall into the classic trap of all negative ads, which is that you're ending on the negative rather than ending on Mitch McConnell's positive. Basically, their ad is flip-flopped. They should be saying that Matt Bevin is bad, McConnell is good. And that's, you always want to leave people on a positive in those, because if you get people all angry and then you talk about your candidate, they're still angry while you're talking about your candidate. It's a psychology thing. Anyway, the result of that, entertainingly, is that Bevin has taken a beating in the polls, in a poll that was just released here a couple days ago. Bevin has taken a beating, and McConnell is down. And Grimes is now ahead of McConnell 46-42, so McConnell hasn't moved, but his ads, in theory, have pushed people towards Grimes. Or alternately, they may have not allowed for people to say some other candidate, and maybe that skewed something. But because I don't have the crosstabs here. But this poll has a plus or minus 3%, which is means that Grimes is officially in the lead. Well, basically, plus or minus 3, rather than the previous poll that had a plus or minus 4. And the poll was conducted by SurveyUSA. SurveyUSA, you know, they've done on a few races, but I've had a lot of respect for them since 2006 when they finally the Libertarian be polled. And from that moment forward, everything made sense, everything was correct, and they nailed that election down to like fractions of a percentage, and I was very impressed. Anyway, the point is, negative ads, that's really, I don't know how many times I've talked about that on this show. People are sick to death of negative ads. My God, they're sick to death of them. And McConnell leads Bevin in the latest poll, 55-29. Now, that's a, what is that? Boy, why is my math so bad? 25%, 26-point margin. So that's a pretty significant margin. Now, that part of the survey had a plus or minus of 4.9%, which just squeaks under the 5% plus or minus point. If you have a poll that has a plus or minus of 5%, it's basically considered junk. So that one's at 4.9% and squeaks in. So it may not be worth the paper it's written on. But based on what I can see, this poll also showed that Grimes is now beating Bevin as well. And so they either overpolled Democrats or that, I don't know if they overpolled or what. I would guess, though, that McConnell's negative ads are both hurting him and Bevin. That's my guess, because voters are sick to death of the negative ads. They're just sick of it. It's just people are done with it. That's it. I don't know. So we'll continue to follow that race as it goes, and, you know, as I think I've mentioned on the show before, the Libertarian Party should have a candidate in that race as well here before too long. Our primary is for that race is March 1st, because the Libertarian Party does an internal process. We don't make the taxpayers pay for pay for our selection process. No corporate welfare over on our side. Anyway, boy, here's a story. Lexington, Kentucky was rated as America's laziest city. And at a time when we're debating the smoking ban and, oh, how bad it is, Lexington, which is the heart of the smoking bans, has been rated the laziest city in America. Now, I hope that my friends in Lexington that are listening aren't thinking that I'm saying Lexington is the laziest city, because I'm not. I'm just saying it was rated that way by Men's Health magazine. I think this is an opportunity for Lexington City Council to put out some sort of, I mean, and it doesn't have to be government funded even, to put out a, I don't know, I guess something like Michelle Obama's Let's Move, but a little less nefarious and a little less silly, and a little more legit, and basically have encourage people to go play soccer and basically play off of this thing, right? And say, well, you know, they rate us the worst city. Let's prove them wrong. You know, I think that that's something that some folks in Lexington should take up that cause and prove Men's Health magazine wrong. Oh, let's see here. Speaking of, yeah, I mentioned the smoking ban. I don't want to get into this. We only have 5 minutes left in the show, but the real short version of this, I was featured in Northern Kentucky Inquirer this weekend, today, on the smoking ban. And the Inquirer, the editorial staff, is for a smoking ban, and they have been all along. They were for it when it was local. They're now for it. Once we beat them back locally, they're for the statewide ban. And basically, they published a number of editorials, and including their own, where they were in favor of the ban. And then apparently they only asked me to write an op-ed. And only gave me 500 words to refute. It was basically 2 pages worth of articles in favor of a smoking ban. So I couldn't even list the number of issues that come up in a smoking ban debate, much less refute them in under 500 words. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So I did my best. It's funny, they actually edited one of my sentences, which is hilarious. I don't know, whatever, you know. At the end of the day, the smoking ban, statewide smoking ban, is completely unnecessary, completely unneeded. There's always a non-smoking alternative out there. And if there's not, encourage a business owner to go non-smoking. There is a market for non-smoking restaurants, for sure. And there's even a market in a large enough area for non-smoking bars, because there are people that like to go out and have a drink and not be exposed to smoke. So cater to them. I had this debate with somebody up here that was a bar owner that was afraid to go non-smoking, and so they were pushing for the smoking ban because they wanted to go non-smoking and were scared. And they ended up going non-smoking anyway, even though we repealed the ban in Campbell County. And I had talked to them. I said, guys, just promote it. Do it and promote it and sell it. Be the niche player. Be the one that says, hey, we're smoke-free by choice. Come here. And you know what? It's worked. They're doing quite well now, and I'm glad that they are. I have nothing angrier or hateful towards them. I know they were scared. But it gets to the point that a lot of times businesses push government programs because they're afraid to compete. We see this with the regulations. Getting back to the beginning of the show, the regulations that are put out there to kill and prevent competition. Well, why do you do that? Are you just scared to compete in the open market? Yeah, I know you've got stuff to lose, but every other person does too. Hey, man, when you went into business for yourself, you started risking everything you had. I mean, that's what being a small business owner is. That's why I admire small business owners. Even the ones that fail, I admire them for trying, because it is a heck of a risk. But that's what the free market is. It's a risk, and it's consumers demanding what they want. And that's how these things happen. We've reaped the benefits in Northern Kentucky of not passing a smoking ban and seeing what the free market would do. And what it's done is it's made over 70% of our restaurants non-smoking. It's made it so that a number of bars now in Northern Kentucky are non-smoking, because once one went and they were successful, another one went, hey, you know what, I'd like to be non-smoking too, and those guys are working, I'm going to go non-smoking too. The point is that there's a market for all of this stuff, the consumers, to drive that market. And we should. We should be talking to business owners on occasion. If there's something that really bothers us, you should tell the business owner, hey, man, you know what? I don't think I'm going to come back here anymore because of this. That feedback actually helps business owners change their business. It's why there are so many restaurants that are smoke-free. There were a lot of people that said, you know what? I love your food, but I don't want to be around the smoke. I'm not going to come back until you go non-smoking. And they didn't come back. And then they went non-smoking, and the people came back. And a lot of restaurants really do better in a non-smoking environment. Heck, I'm a smoker, and I don't like being, you know, consumed in a smoky pool hall while I'm eating. I mean, that's when you're eating food, that's not what you want. But when you're at a bar, it's what you expect. And again, you can cater to the niche that says, I want to go to a bar, but I don't want to be around smoke. And that's what the smoke-free bars in Northern Kentucky have figured out, is there is a market for that. It's not certainly not every bar. That's the big funny part about it, is actually pushing a ban across everybody. All that does is spread misery, because now you've taken all the non-smokers and tried to push them out across all the bars. And the ones who were smokers, guys, that's the whole idea that the smokers still come is wrong. It's wrong. I talked to business owners in Ohio. I talked to business owners in other states where they've passed a ban. Michigan's been decimated because the weather there is horrible. Who wants to stand outside in a blizzard to have a cigarette? Not me. I'll just stay home. And that's what's happened. So rather than pushing these policies down, we let the free market do its thing. We let people, individuals, drive individual decisions. And that's the way it should be. I just noticed I'm over, and I got to go. So, folks, I thank you for tuning in. I didn't realize I was over here, but I thank you, folks, for tuning into the show tonight. It's been a pleasure as usual. I apologize. I've been a little slower. I'm exhausted. It's been a long, 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 long week. But thanks for tuning in. Folks, tune in again next week to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. Tune into the shows, the rest of the shows on the network. And until next week, I hope you all have a good week. Stay safe, and hopefully it'll be warmer this week. I haven't even had a chance to check. Take care, folks. Good week.